Hello there, and welcome to the Comic Book Tesseract, the weekly comics netcast that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. I'm Justin Chalupka. Every week, we review and preview the world of comics, along with other facets of geek chic culture. We got a lot of fun stuff to talk about this week. First up, Jason, how you doing this week, man?
Doing well, Justin. How are you?
Can't complain. I had a relatively large stack this week. I think you had a pretty sizable one as well.
Yes, and we had a special guest commentator commenting on their own comic book.
Yeah. We have a little one in studio, I suppose you could say, although she's being soundproofed at the moment to make sure we don't get a little, too much extra feedback on our show. Last thing we needed somebody coming up behind us going, "What are you doing?"
So we're going to go ahead and get started with our reviews.
Mm-hmm. And let's get through as quick as we can to try to prevent that.
Yeah. All right. First up on the list, Action Comics.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, this one is going to be taking its licks because this was kind of closing an arc that had been opened at the end of issue number 5. It was just like a brief thing happened at the end of 5. This was kind of closing it, and I guess it's going to be moving on into the next storyline in 7, which is the one that I've been really kind of itching for, although I think that's Superman.
Yeah, that's Superman that you're waiting on number 7 for. But, yeah, this definitely actually worked pretty well as a standalone issue. That's kind of one of the things that I liked about it, is it did work kind of self-contained. There wasn't much you needed from the previous issue. It did kind of irk me that you had this issue going through 1 through 5, a story arc, and then all of a sudden you kind of shifted gears because the end of 5 didn't really direct... It had that jump-off point which led into this, but you still kind of have a lot of unresolved stuff from what's happening in those previous 5 issues.
Which, possibly, that some of that may have been resolved if either of us had been reading Legion, because I think Legion probably is what brings it into this book. But what this really does punctuate is the whole 5-year difference between Action Comics and the Superman title.
Yeah, it does talk about that a little bit, but for most of this book, actually, it's Superman in the new uniform, the armored uniform, mm-hmm. and he's out there with Legion, he's dealing, it boasts Superman's first flight, which we get is mm-hmm. from a Legion flight ring, which is understandable, because they talked, because they started off, he's a deep-powered Superman, he can jump really far, but he can't really fly, so to have the Legion flight ring be his first flight, it's kind of a neat little twist on that.
Yeah. Which I have to admit, just as a side note, I like the idea of the evolving Superman. I think that was a neat twist that they did in the new DCU that I think is important for this character because between his genesis in the, what was it, late 50s? In the late 30s to the present day Superman pre-new DCU, that character evolved. He did start only able to jump over buildings and, push stuff and stuff like that.
Well, you were probably thinking about the 50s TV show, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound.
Absolutely.
Because he did leap at that time. He wasn't flying. Yeah, so the character has evolved. He's grown more powerful. There's been times, like after Infinite Crisis on Infinite Earths, where they scaled back his powers. Mm-hmm. And they took away the infinite number of visions that he had. So that, he was a weaker character, which made him actually easier to write. It's harder to write a character that can do everything.
Well, we'll get to that a little bit in Irredeemable, I think, when we get there. So, the other thing I did like about this issue is this was the first time I felt that two-story issue that we've talked about before that was a detective, and I think they even did it in action as well with the fight that John Johns had against the guy who I can't remember.
Jeff Johns, you mean. Not John Johns. John Johns would be the Martian Manhunter.
Martian Manhunter. No, it's not Jeff Johns, because Jeff Johns is the artist and the writer. Steel.
John Henry Irons.
John Irons. Thank you,
John. John Henry Irons, yes.
Okay, there are way too many names in this universe and in this business. Yeah. Anyways, side stories. This was the first time I felt that the side story itself was enjoyable. I mean, I really liked reading that behind-the-scenes story, because it fleshed out this new universe a little bit more. It gave us information we didn't know before about the current state of Ma and Pa Kent.
Yeah.
That
had officially been revealed.
Yeah, heavily alluded to, I should say. Even if it's not spoken outright in canon, it's at least mentioned. But it was a really good, solid, fun story, which the other ones I felt really haven't been.
Yeah, but it tied you emotionally to the character because it was about, his grounding in Kansas and leaving Smallville, you know, why he was leaving, his friends, and how they reacted to his leaving,
yeah,
and seeing that whole era. The interesting thing I felt about that is they showed him...
The sex appeal of Lana Lane.
No.
I found that interesting.
Well, Lana's always been kind of that, yeah, sister slash girlfriend, not sure where that relationship is, kind of a thing.
Well, considering that Superman has stepped away from the Lois Lane love triangle, it was good to see a little bit of tension in a Superbook.
But what was interesting is when they're showing Clark as a little kid, he's wearing glasses.
Mm-hmm.
When, yeah, the traditional continuity, he never had a need to wear glasses until he went to Metropolis and started saving people when all of a sudden he needed some sort of a disguise. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he couldn't just be a guy in a suit, you know, doing stuff. He got a pair of his dad's old glasses. Yeah, that's where it came from, was when he went to Metropolis and started saving people. He goes, wait, I need some disguise, but it's too late to put on a mask.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll put a mask on in my regular everyday life. You know? So why he's, you know, as this 8-year-old kid, this 12-year-old kid, this 18-year-old kid in Smallville wearing glasses, meeting the Legion wearing glasses, he didn't need them as a kid. So that is one of those small little details that irks me. And I don't know if it's that... a conscious decision, or it was it's Clark Kent. Clark Kent wears glasses. But it's nitpicky. I did enjoy this story. Again, it was pretty much a one-shot.
Yeah, it definitely. Definitely was.
Yeah, and yeah, I love the idea of the villains actually being in Superman's brain. Yeah, and not in a telekinetic way. Yeah, not in a...
Yeah, physically in his brain.
Yeah, which was really cool. So.
Oh, you just liked it because they were in a Tesseract space.
Okay, so they stole the name of our show for their hideout.
Yeah,
that's okay.
I liked it, but it's a bias.
Yes.
Next up, we were going to talk about is Avengers X Sanction, which I think this book was kind of like a marshmallow. It's nothing but fluffy air, but it's very tasty, and you like it.
Well, I'll give you that McGinnis's characters are definitely fluffy and airy and marshmallowy.
You don't like his bubble style, but
no.
For me, the story itself is, there's nothing, I can't take this book seriously in any way, shape, or form. It is nothing more than, like, just cosmic kablooskies. I mean, it's
an excuse for Cable to fight the Avengers. Now, there were some interesting things throughout this book, particularly when you get to look at the details. Why the hell was Gambit's staff, you know, worked on by Iron Man and turned into some sort of Stark Tech weapon? Where would there ever be a need for Gambit to do Stark Tech on his staff? It was a bow staff. That's all he needed to be. If he ever needed more, he charged
it. Well, no, Forge got a hold of it for a while, and he did make it that he could charge his energy into it and use it for other things. So it had been tech upgraded once already. Not by Stark.
Yeah, I must have missed that arc when Forge did that. So knowing that, then it adds a little bit of sense to it. The other actual little detail that I liked about this is as Cable's succumbing to the technovirus and it takes over his full body, yeah, his eye that had previously been human doesn't glow. And as it continues to work, it does start to glow throughout the issue. So it was one of those small details
that they
carried through. And I actually liked that. Yeah, because he's always had that glowing eye on his left side.
Which was that the virus, or is that the? I think that was just Nathan Summers, because even as X-Man, he'd had that glowing eye when he was doing his mojo.
But yeah, here, yeah, his robotic side had the glowing eye, and his human side didn't.
Yeah.
Now that as the technovirus took over, it wasn't glowing, and then it started to. So it was just another evolution of the technovirus. More than just the full physical appearance of the character. It showed something deeper.
Mm-hmm. So, now, Red Hulk in this gets infected with the virus. Do you think that's going to continue on through into the rest of the storylines?
It could. There's certainly, you know...
Or I don't know if they'll say something that, like, the gamma radiation somehow is...
Maybe they'll just kill him because they think there's too many Hulks. And we've talked about the whole rainbow of Hulks.
Yeah, that's true.
Then again,
Isn't Grey coming back?
Maybe they got Black Hulk. Well, we'll discuss Black Hulk
we'll
later.
Say Black Hulk.
But yeah, I hear you mumbling over there. Now, but with the Red Hulk, yeah, it could be that something with the gamma radiation actually takes place and is able to fight off the technovirus,
or keeps it from grabbing on in the first place, or something.
But I think it'll be interesting to actually see an amalgam of the Hulk and the Technovirus. That could be a real interesting.
That could be entertaining.
And unfortunately, you can't trust Cable's future because, as we know in comic books, the future is always changing, always malleable. And just because that's what's predicted doesn't mean it's going to happen. It's one of those the future is changeable type scenarios. So yeah. Because even though the Red Hulk was a different person, and so in theory, Thunderbolt Ross as the Hulk is dead, doesn't necessarily make it true. There's all sorts of things that could happen in here. And that is, I guess, one of the other things, aside from that little detail, the fact that it is completely open at this point.
Yeah.
But we know this is going to lead into X-Men versus Avengers.
Which, I have a feeling that's going to continue to be this sort of... I see it as food with no filling.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a creamy Twinkie filling if there's a...
Well, that's the thing. I feel bad kind of almost dogging on Marvel like this because I don't want them... I don't want to think that people, or have people think I only portray them as like the junk food of comics, but really they're not giving me much more to work with on that. So
there's been a number of books where I can certainly feel that same thing. And I think maybe that's why they do so well in a lot of their stuff is because they can give you this lot of action, lot of fluff stories. And they do have a couple of other books for the people that really want to dig in and get into the meat of the characters.
Yeah. So. Moon Knight.
Oh, you mean the one that's getting canceled in issue 12?
Yes, that's exactly what I mean.
All right. Okay. If nothing else,
it's a commentary on the junk food nature of our culture, if nothing else.
That's one of the things that I really am liking about with DC Comics is I do feel they delve into some of the depth of the characters. So, for me, I like that they're digging in and eating and finding that meat and what the characters are there. And that's why I think I enjoyed DC books, but it could also be why DC hasn't been doing so well that they did the relaunch.
That is true, because I can't even think of who the author was. It's the author of Unknown Soldier, I think, said it best. Books about genocide don't really sell very well.
And yet, the X-Men seem to be doing quite well with the genocide of the mutants. I think it's how the stories are told, and you're going to be getting Unknown Soldier back. It won't be the same.
Yeah,
GI Combat, Palmiotti, and
so it's on my radar. That one's definitely on my radar because I want to see where they go with it. But I think they're going to throw it back to the older Unknown Soldier as opposed to the new one.
Yeah, they have said that they are going to go back, but they're actually trying to reinvent the character. Anyways, off topic because none of this has anything to do with now. X-Sanction. Yeah. We've gone down that rabbit hole. Yeah. We've gotten away from the actual book we're reviewing.
Let's go ahead and move on to the next one then, because it's kind of in the same vein, which is Marvel the Defenders,
right.
Which I, again, feel it's more of this just Saturday morning cartoon kind of storyline. There's no meat to it. It's funny, it's entertaining, but there's nothing here that I would use to pose as an argument if somebody was going to argue with me on whether comics were art or literature. This is not a book I would bring up as an example.
Unless you were defending the position that comics...
Which I don't. I do feel that comics are literature, that comics are art, and in many, many different ways. Even the mainstream stuff is just...
It's not high art.
This book you'd have to dig a little bit deeper to find it.
Now, and this book actually is doing something neat. If you look along the bottom of each page, there's usually a little thing. Sometimes it says continues on page after next.
Mm-hmm.
To let you know the story continues on the page after. It's kind of a throwback to the old comic book days. Sometimes it's just plain funny.
Oh, yeah. It'd be like, oh, snap. She didn't just punch him in the face. Yes, she did. Which I have to admit, I really like those.
Occasionally there are actually comments on the story. Sometimes there are advertisements for other books.
Sometimes. There's actually a webcomic called Order the Stick that has these little demonic cockroaches that make appearances in the comic that have the sort of running commentary throughout the line. These bylines do that exact same thing, where it gives you that sort of, the omniscient narrator giving you, telling you what it is that you're already thinking.
Yeah, and I actually Order the Stick just became the highest grossing comic on Kickstarter to have its previous books reprinted.
Really?
Yes.
Fantastic.
Did not put that in the news stories, so we'll go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
So, Not much to say.
Yeah.
They did really well with Kickstarter to get their previous books republished.
Excellent.
Actually, my favorite of the little story arcs was a story interrupted second page previous. You don't even know that your story's being interrupted until after you skip the ad to get back to the story. So there's some fun in there. As for the actual story of this book, There was a big Deus Ex Machina.
There was a story here?
Yeah, and it was that the heroes of this book do absolutely nothing to save the day. Yeah, that was actually the biggest thing that I hated about this book. I could have dealt with, you know, the candy nature of it. It's the fact that the heroes who we've been following for the three books don't do anything to actually save the day.
Exception. Surfer.
Okay, Surfer.
Surfer's the only one that actually has any active role in stopping a bad guy.
Yes.
And all the rest of them are just kind of going, hey, what's going on? Oh, the day was saved.
But by the time the Surfer does that, you know, the day has actually been saved. All he's doing is preventing the bad guy from getting away and sending him off to, you know, appear some point in the future when he can do more bad. Yeah. So really, he still gets away. He just doesn't get away the way he intended. There was really no fault. And the other thing is the big baddie of this book. We mentioned that we're going to get back to the Black Hulk. We're back to the Black Hulk. Null? Yeah. Oh, wait. Yeah, page and a half, and he's gone with some...
Well, he was breaking his way through walls the whole way in. He was sort of like... He was the death timer on the whole thing.
And the big baddie comes in, shows up, and then absolutely nothing. Not even the heroes have... You know, the heroes spend a little bit of time fighting him. Maybe there's some sort of a delay, but...
Nothing more than like sticking their foot out in front of him, trying to trip him up. Yeah, that's about all they managed to get.
Yeah, there was really no act of the heroes doing something to all of a sudden win.
Yeah, although no, I take that back. I did like She-Hulk getting bit and her griping about it. That was kind of funny.
And we learned that her blood is acid, so that's fine.
Yeah. So she's an alien.
Yeah. So next time we will know. Yeah, do not put her in space because she'll
kill all the Marines.
No, she's going to turn into H.H. Geiger designs.
So. Ooh, yeah, no, keep her like she is. She looks pretty like she is.
All right, I think we've killed this book because it deserved to be killed. Unfortunately, there's one more issue that I know of coming out, so we'll have one more.
I'll pick it up.
Maybe the heroes will do something heroic in the next book.
yeah, right. It ends on, let's steal stuff. Yeah, I don't think so.
All right, well, then let's go to Detective Comics. Did we have any heroic action in that book?
We had so much action in this book, and I don't know what any of it was.
But it's because there really wasn't much action. We were introduced to characters that we really don't care about. They're new introductions, as far as I can tell, for the DC New You, for the Batman universe. And I don't know why I'm caring about following these particular characters. I don't know what they're really up to, what their endgame is. I don't know what their motivation is. So to have all this going on, and there's no Batman,
the Evil League of Evil sitting around the table in Penguin's bar, it was like I was reading Dr. Horrible sing-along comic.
Okay. I
would not have been surprised had there been a horse at the head of the table. Wouldn't have been surprised.
I'll give you that the Penguin does you, while he portrays to be a legitimate businessman with the casino and with the restaurant Iceberg Lounge, he still is the guy you go to for information, for permission to work.
Yeah.
Or at least he's had that role through various incarnations in DC. So to have him back at that role, I understand.
I have no problem with the role. I have a problem with the people around it. It was the most ridiculous collection of like meta characters.
I kind of felt that they were aiming for meta a little bit.
It was tongue in cheek. It was tongue through cheek because I think they kind of overdid it a bit.
Yeah, but I was talking about how I don't really care for the characters in this. The main characters that were actually driving this, the two sisters, that one's trying to destroy the Iceberg Lounge, and I'm not sure why. The other who's trying to get the inside story on the criminal empire that's hosted there. Which, okay, she's a reporter. That actually makes some sense.
Yeah, a little bit.
But in the end, you wind up having one of these characters trapped with Batman and. Well, it's Batman. He's going to escape. Why do I even care? There's nothing really on the line there. If there were characters that Batman, they've tried to make it so it's a character that Batman actually cares about, so that there's something at stake if Batman doesn't save this character. But I still don't feel that emotional grab, that draw, to have me care that the other character survives because of how it's going to affect Batman.
You know, I almost think this book is a good explanation of a physics lesson, of the difference between force and power. This book had a lot of force, but it had no power because there was no actual movement. Nothing was actually being done by this book. There was a lot of force in it. There was a lot of stuff moving and happening and going on, and she's running doing this, and this was running doing that, and this big convoluted plot. And at the end of it, you got nowhere. It was like a salmon swimming upstream. I mean, it did all this work and ended up nowhere at the end.
At least the salmon gets to spawn at the end, yeah. There wasn't that fun in this book. This book was totally irredeemable. And speaking of...
wow.
Yes, I know. I did the segue.
Wow. Okay,
we're back. We're going to go ahead and talk about irredeemable
now. I don't think we should ever do segues ever again. Just because of that.
But they're fun two-wheeled vehicles that balance themselves.
Oh.
All right. Irredeemable. This story, I think, is what you were looking for when we reviewed Incorruptible previously.
Yeah, exactly. This is exactly what I was looking for last week.
Good, so you got it.
No, this one was very disappointing, actually.
Really? Why?
I like the direction that the book is going, but I feel like the novelty that was Irredeemable at the beginning has been lost. This started out with Superman going just utterly bonkers and having this unstoppable force literally just doing whatever he wanted regardless of the depravity. And that has kind of gone away now, which...
It has gone away, but there's a twist in here, and now we're actually looking into the psyche of that character.
Yeah.
Because and it actually started before this arc where they started looking at why and what he wanted. What was he looking for? What caused him to trip and lose it? And why is he now going off? You know, why did he start destroying everything? It was because he felt unappreciated.
Yeah.
And now they're actually looking further and deeper into that. This is a new arc, and I actually feel that this is going to be leading into a good place for this book. I'm excited about where this is going.
Don't get me wrong. I do like where the book is going. I will continue to pick this up. It will continue to be a good story. I felt that it had shifted a little bit towards standard fare to a degree, away from where it started. I think my biggest gripe with this book is the fact that with the closing of the previous one and the arrival of Max Damage and Qubit, I was ready for a good-on, irredeemable, incorruptible crossover. And instead, Max Damage is there for about three panels long enough to go, oh, wait, you just brought me here for no reason? Okay, I'm leaving. And he disappears.
Yeah.
Worthless. I mean, absolutely worthless. He was there for the shock factor of the last panel, and then, okay, get him out of here as quick as possible.
Yeah, well, there is that, but there's also so much going on with the characters, the building of the characters around this, and you've got the whole team of superheroes, which... have been decimated, and they don't know how they're going to win, and they're trapped underneath, and they've actually found the Tree of Life, and they're going to use that to try and kickstart the growth on the world. But you've got heroes that are lost in how to save themselves and how to save the planet.
Well, they're lost on how to be heroes.
Yes. And so there's an interesting take on that. And the other half is, Qubit, I think, is starting to lose it himself. And he's a genius, and there's a fine line between genius and insanity.
Yeah.
And I think Qubit is towing that line, and he's wobbly, and I think he could go.
He's starting to edge over a little bit.
That's exactly what I'm thinking, and I love seeing that. It may be that he's doing it. It may be that he's got the other main villain who's been transferring his consciousness from body to body. Maybe he's in Qubit's head a little bit. I don't know that that's what's that's the case. It may not be. I don't think it is. But there's still something kind of there, like. As if he is, you got Qubit losing it. So you've got this is about people with power finding out that not just with power comes great responsibility, but power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Absolutely. So we've seen the Plutonian become absolutely corrupted. Now we're actually seeing the power of mind with Qubit being corrupted as he's trying to control the power that is Plutonian.
Well, trying to control the situation more so than trying to control Tony himself. I mean,
I think like a chess player, he's setting up situations to control what the player is going to. He's forcing the gambit to make him go a certain way.
Which is the same thing that Modius was doing previously, and now you're getting, like you said, it's looking like
chess.
It is.
And the beautiful thing is, there's so much that can happen with this book. And I really don't know which way this book is going to go most times. And I saw something that said this is a great jump on point, and actually it is.
I'd be willing to say that. Yeah.
Following the redemption story arc, this book, it's issue 34, so it'd be a good start on point for this story. And we're, again, the Plutonian is learning he has new powers. So.
Yeah, and the more that he kind of delves into that, maybe he will come back into that sort of super-powered despot that's just going to completely put his foot down over everybody. But maybe he'll do it as the benevolent leader. He'll be a benevolent despot.
Yes, I am the Messiah. Do follow me, and
just like we were saying
in Superman, in the Superman title.
Yeah, except there isn't anybody that can stop him, including himself.
Yeah, well, that's also part of it, is because you've got so many people that are trying to stop him, trying to figure out ways to stop him. Yeah, you've got Cubit and Modius who are trying to outthink him. You've got the other heroes who are trying anything desperate to, and they had some characters that you thought might be powerful enough. And
then
they completely get wiped out. So
and destroy themselves, which in itself is...
It's the fight for power in and of itself. So there's...
I think we can round this out by saying, this is a good book. This is a good title. This is a good series. Irredeemable is one that's worth picking up week after week.
Yeah, and if you're one of those that's a completionist, go pick up the first trade
and go from there. Because you'll like it from the beginning.
Yeah. And, okay.
Well, next one up is Valen the Outcast.
Also
from Boom Studios, yeah. Valen, just as a quick little review, Conan the Barbarian as a zombie.
That's fairly accurate.
Which
the King of Samaria as the King of Samaria zombie.
Right. Well, let me put it this way for the kiddies out there who shouldn't be listening to this because this is marked as an explicit podcast. Go tell your parents. This is actually very similar to a storyline that was done in World of Warcraft, which made your eye twitch there. That was kind of interesting. I like that. That was good. I'll say this outright. This is what the World of Warcraft comics that were done not too long ago should have been.
Okay.
This type of story, this type of line, they have it's an undead prince that's out doing his thing. He's thrown away his kingdom. He's doing his undead princely things.
Right.
He never had a heart armor, though. Best idea ever.
I gotta say, that was really cool to have the heart armor, which actually takes place issue 2. Because of some damage in shipping, we didn't get issue 2 till we got issue 3. So we actually read those both back to back. To me, I think that may have actually helped with issue 3, because it's basically it's a giant chase scene. Now, they do reveal some stuff about the characters, which I really love when you have a scene like a chase, and you get to have some exposition, or you are able to move the story on. So, they did actually reveal stuff, but I think having read issue 2 immediately before issue 3 may have helped just a little bit with carrying it through.
Not only that, but they also gave a reveal about something, and they haven't even shown it yet.
Yeah, they've definitely introduced, the monster that lurks in the dark. It's the nothing that existed in the never-ending story that you never see until the end of the movie, and you still don't really see it.
Right.
So they revealed that there's something out there that scares these characters.
It even scares the dead guy. That ought to tell you something.
So there's some very neat, some very inventive things that this book is doing with the characters. Like you said, the heart armor, the giant creature that we don't know about, and probably won't be mentioned for another couple of issues would be my guess.
Oh, yeah. I seriously doubt it. You've been using this phrase a lot lately, so I feel like I have to jump on. The monster itself might become the Deus Ex Machina when the bad guys show up, that it'll sort of be like the wrecking ball to knock them to the side to clear the path.
Yeah, but
I could see it being used like that.
I could also see it being one of those things, the monster shows up and the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and they join with the people chasing them to take out that giant monster.
Yeah, potentially.
There's lots of different ways this could go. I always love when they come up with an angle that you don't normally see coming through with this.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be that it becomes its own little story arc. At one point, they have to go get something that the monster has. They're just like, oh, the giant's treasure tomb, we have to go after it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot going on here. Actually, the other thing that was interesting is the way that book 3 ended. Which, did the end of the book remind you of anything? Because it certainly reminded me of it. I can see why it would remind me more so than you.
I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but...
I'm thinking when Han Solo arrives at Bespin.
Okay.
And,
yeah,
Han, my good buddy!
My good buddy!
Yeah. Yes. Lando, how are you? Good, you're under arrest.
Chick.
So, okay, we've ruined the beginning of the book, but I'm sorry. I immediately thought of that. It was funny, and it sets up the problem that they're going to be facing in book four, which is how do they get out of the jail that they've just been put into by the guy's friend.
Now, to give a more sort of general nod to the book as a whole, and the writer specifically, he's been doing a fantastic job of world building.
And absolutely.
In 3 comic issues, so in, essentially 66 pages, give or take.
Right.
He has really flushed out a rather robust and I would dare say, a lore deep world.
Yeah, I mean, you've got, you know, armies and nations that want to fight each other. You've
not mentioned power sources in the sort of witch companion of theirs.
Right.
The actual fighting styles, the power of the undead themselves, the supernatural power of the wield, the monsters that are in the world.
Yeah, the lay of the land and how there's, you know, different areas, you know, the path that people don't go down because the big monster's down it.
Yeah.
The path that everybody stays on. So there's a lot of, you know, lore that you're at least finding out hints and bits about, which is actually what I love about, you know, even though they're in a chase,
and even a nod
things
to both,
being revealed.
Even a nod to both biology and physics.
Yeah.
Yeah, pigs burn hot.
Yes. Pigs do burn hot. Me love me some pig in a blanket. And actually, one of the other things that I really loved about this book, aside from the world building that's going on while all the action happens, is, you know, you've got a great secondary character who's a smartass.
Oh, yeah.
And he'll keep you laughing throughout the book, which is necessary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you have the overserious girl, you have the, I guess how to say, the tacit hero, and the wise Alex sidekick.
Yeah.
Ooh, wait a minute.
He's not a sidekick. You can't.
Wait a minute.
He would hate to be called a sidekick.
We're reading Hercules.
Hercules.
With the Xena crossover.
There's probably, the problem is with, when you get to these genres, they all Xena. Borrow from each other.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we started off calling this Conan. I mean, there's elements.
Granted, that
from
was how it was sold. That was a marketing thing.
That is true. Yeah, and it's swords and sorcery. There is magic in this world. But at least so far, magic is not very pervasive. Yeah, there are beings that use magic. There are ruins. There's mysticism. But magic hasn't been shown to be hugely powerful. So
you'd say this isn't, which very much is Conan. It's not high fantasy. The magic that's there is very rare, and it's very powerful.
Yeah. So a lot of stuff going on. I think we both like this book. And
yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm definitely going to continue it.
I will, too. So, all right. Speaking of things that I'm continuing with, Winter Soldier, which is a continuation of Captain America and Bucky from the pages of Captain America. This is actually following Bucky's character, who, if you're not familiar with Bucky, he's Cap's original sidekick from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And just as, you know, Cap died, Bucky also supposedly died during World War II. It's later been found out that the Russians had found Bucky, who was frozen near death, and drug him from the water and put him into stasis, where they then brainwashed him, trained him, gave him a new robotic arm, and then used him for wet works operations, espionage, assassinations, and,
you know, fun stuff.
Absolutely. Now, Bucky is broken free of the chain that he was under with the Soviets, and he's now trying to deal with his past. He doesn't like the fact that he was doing some very nasty, dirty, despicable things.
For communists.
For communists and as an assassin, I mean, killing whole families.
Hmm.
Yeah. He's a soldier. He understands that people need to be killed, and he understands that sometimes you have to use snipers or similar type people to accomplish your mission. But when you're taking out an entire family and saying, oh, collateral, we got our guy, that doesn't sit well with him. So he really hated that about himself. And this is this story arc is about Bucky finding out that he wasn't the only Winter Soldier. The Winter Soldier was the code name that they used for Bucky, and I guess the whole program of special trained spies and assassins that they would keep in stasis until they were needed.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, if they're not around, they can't be found.
Yeah. Well, he's actually trying to hunt them down to...
Yeah. Now,
I don't know what he plans to do when he finds them.
Well,
that wasn't really well explained.
Well, yeah, they haven't gone into... I think he just wants to rescue them and perhaps actually break the brainwashing that's been used on them.
Give them a choice, as long as it's his choice.
Well, not even that. I think, you know.
Sorry, that's my cynicism poking through.
Yeah, to some extent, you're right. It is give them a choice as long as it's my choice. And maybe they will be people that are going to go back and go to that assassin's lifestyle. Maybe, you know, we don't really know who these people are to know if they're Russian soldiers that volunteered for this program because they wanted to be those killers. But he wants them to at least have the opportunity to know, this is what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to continue doing it? And who knows? Maybe they'll start working for S.H.I.E.L.D. doing the same type of job if that's what they want to do.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll retire. Yeah, there's a lot that could go on. He just doesn't like the idea that these people are still out there and can be used by not even the Russians anymore. Now they're being sold on the black market to do hits, so groups like Hydra or AIM can go, oh, I got a hit that I need to take care of. I'm going to hire this. I've got this soldier that I keep in storage. He's going to go out, do the hit, come back, be put back in storage, and never have to. And we don't have to worry about him being found out because he doesn't exist.
Right.
Yeah. So
I do have to say, overall, this book, and I think just books of this style really aren't my cup of tea. This one in particular, though, the spy-like aspects of it didn't feel spy-y enough. The military bits didn't feel military enough. It just, I mean, anything that's based on, you know, communists are bad and Cold War stuff to me just makes me want to gag on the cheese, except for pigs, because pigs is awesome.
All right. And those pigs burn hot.
And pigs burn hot. I don't know about these pigs, but anyways.
So,
you know, just overall, I mean, it had a very dark, kind of gloomy mood, which I suppose fits with this type of story.
And it's the mood that they've been using for most of the Winter Soldier books, even back when they were doing Cap and they first revealed that Bucky was still alive. You know, back in the current volume of Cap, issue 15, which actually, they now have gone to like numbering it in 600s again. But
which I think overall...
So it's actually the old previous version of Cap.
Yeah. Which, I mean, overall, I have to say, it fits with this book. It really does, but it just makes it feel a bit whiny, I guess, in a way. Not that the character himself is, because that doesn't seem to be the case, but the book itself just feels like it's sort of, I don't know, self-deprecating in a way.
Yeah,
does he have like a hologram thing on his arm, by the way?
His left arm is cybernetic, and I believe he's, with the upgrade that he got, it's now able to look like it's human flesh, or it can be the silver arm with the Captain America logo on it. So, the S.H.I.E.L.D. logo on it. I like this art style. I've loved it since, you know, we were seeing it, this similar stuff back in the Cap run with Winter Soldier.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I like the dark, moody feel. It's Brubaker. It's what Brubaker does. Like, he does noir. He does mystery. And this, you're right, this isn't quite as spy-y. It isn't quite as straight-up military-y. It's not quite straight superhero-y. It's a mish of all three, so it doesn't do any of them exceptionally well. Mm-hmm. But I still... I'm interested to see where this is going to go, because this is going to play on who Bucky is, what it means to him to stop this, what his relationship is with Natasha the Black Widow. Mm-hmm. So... It's seeing how this is going to affect Bucky, and if Brubaker starts delving deeper into that, which he had done for a while in Cap. So seeing him delve into that, I think, is what's really going to carry this book for me. And if he does that, I'm on board. I'm going to give him a couple to get going.
And that's something that Brubaker is good at. But I suppose for me, it's more of a, you know, I look at the comic shelf every week, you know, or every month for that matter, and I look at four different titles and go, oh, look, a noir drama by Brubaker, a noir drama by Brubaker, a noir drama by Brubaker. He's got Fatale out there. He's got, he's not the one doing Near Death, is he?
No, he's not doing Fatale, but he's done Criminal, he's done Incognito.
Incognito is what I was trying to think of before.
They're great, but
they're all the same thing, though.
But but there's so much you can do in those universes that the stories are going to be different. Yeah, it's kind of like saying, I looked at the bookshelf and Stephen King wrote a horror story and a horror story and a horror story and a horror story.
Yeah, and he also wrote The Green Mile. He also wrote Stand By Me. He also wrote...
Which is a horror story.
Stand By Me?
It's about going to find a dead body.
It's morbid. That doesn't make it a horror story.
It's
a coming-of-age tale.
When
was the last time Richard Dreyfuss was in a horror movie, honestly?
Okay, but you've got... King does branch out periodically, and Brubaker's doing that too. This is a superhero. It's got a noir feel to it, but
all right.
So and he loves crime. I mean, he did great with Gotham Central. You know, he was writing that with with Greg Rucka. Yeah. So he likes doing crime, and there's enough crime in superhero books that he can write the crime.
I could make a joke about him doing crime and equating it to his writing, but I'll leave that right there for you.
Okay. Well then. For me, this is kind of like coming home again for a new series doing the same stuff that I was reading before. Mm-hmm. For you, it's not your flavor.
No, it's really not.
But, that's why we're doing this book with as a pair, because we don't always like everything.
Yeah.
I mean, you actually still like Red Hood and the Outlaws for some unknown godforsaken reason.
Yeah. It's the DC version of comic marshmallow. That's why.
Actually,
it's a different flavor of marshmallow. It's the chocolate marshmallow. That's why.
Okay, then. All right.
This is the best analogy I could come up with.
I think it's time for us to move on, Count Chocula.
Yeah, I think so.
All right.
Booberry is better.
Books that I read that you did not read this week. Villains for Hire. I actually like the second issue better than the third issue. I just don't feel connected to these characters. It feels a bit like that marshmallow fluff we were talking about. Mm-hmm. So there's one more issue left. There's a big reveal at the end. I'll see where it's going. Part of this may just be I don't know enough about the Marvel continuity currently. I've been out of it, and I'm getting back into it, but I'm not feeling connected to these characters or this book. They're not villainy enough sometimes. Uncanny X-Men. This book I did love. Yeah, so this is a Marvel book that I kind of felt coming home to. Even though there's a couple of X-Men characters that are not my traditional X-Men. You know, Magneto was a villain when I read X-Men, not a hero. Still, you know, this book deals with the new land, Tabula Rasa, which was created by X-Force at the end of their Apocalypse saga. This is the second issue dealing with this. Mainly follows Psylocke and Magneto as they fight the Immortal Man. And again, this is a story that through the exposition of the story, they give you a history of who the Immortal Man is. They give you a history of Tabula Rasa and the creatures that have lived there. And you know what's happened a little bit behind the scenes that kind of sets up what's going to be happening in the future.
Wait. Yes. I bet the Immortal Man is a dude that can't die.
Actually, right now he just seems to be a dude with Iron Man's War Machine armor. So
weak.
But we really don't know. While they did reveal some about the history of Tabula Rasa and who's there and what's going to happen, we don't really know exactly what's going on. It can probably know it's a robot. We do know it can phase shift through dimensions.
Hmm.
So you know, there's some interesting stuff going on there.
Sounds fun.
And I'm looking forward to seeing where this is going to go. Yeah. Sergio Argonos, Aragones, Funnies. Really?
Still good.
Do I have to review this again? It's Sergio Aragonés doing what Sergio Aragonés does in a book. Read it. It's fun.
If you've grown past Mad Magazine, read this instead.
Yeah, this it gives some autobiographical stories. It gives some actual stories. It has some games. It has some stuff that you see in his Mad. But it's a little bit wider in breadth than just what you're going to get from his Mad stuff. G.I. Joe, Real American Hero. Lots of ninja action in this book. It's Snake Eyes, Storm Shadow, Boris, who's the leader of the Russian leader of the Arashnikov clan, that somehow the wound up in New York. Cobra Commander and the Baroness are all headed off after the Blue Ninjas to seek revenge for the death of Billy. Billy was Cobra Commander's son, which Baroness kind of nursed him and brought him through his childhood to kill his father. And, of course, she's Cobra Commander's son, so there's a whole lot of back history between them. Storm Shadow then rescued Billy from prison, taught him to be a ninja. There's all sorts of wackiness. You really need to have read most of the story to understand the backstory of this. If you just want to see ninjas fighting, this is the story for you.
Fair enough.
Moving on to something that actually has some meat on the bones, though, because that was just ninjas fighting. It was marshmallow fluff.
Yeah.
But it was the marshmallow that I really enjoy. Moving on to something that actually has some meat on the bones, it's Batwing. That Judd Winnick has done a great job with these characters. I love the way that the emotion of the character drives what he's doing. It's very much that take that, just like Batman, he's got that emotion of bad things have happened to me. I need to use that to stop it from happening to other people. So there's a connection right there. We actually get to see the first meeting between the character who would become Batwing and Bruce and Batman himself, as he says, "Hey, look, I need you to be. I like what you're doing. I'm going to bring you in to become Batwing." And we also see a setup from the past of Just Two Massacre, the villain that he's been chasing throughout the entire arc up to now, who this villain is, and it's paying off with the emotions and the histories that they've been bringing out in the past couple of books. So I love that they're using the character to drive this book. It's not just flat-out action sequences. And there's a lot of action in this book. So, and the art, it's a very unique art style because it's done with the computer colorized. So It's that pseudo-realistic computerized look, which I really enjoy.
I have a feeling probably when Batwing comes out in trade, that's going to be one I'll grab and trade and try to catch up on. Because everything I've heard about this has sounded better and better.
Yeah, I'm loving it. There's going to be an artist shift in it coming up soon. Hmm. Doesn't matter. I'm still going to be getting it. As long as
Winnick keeps writing it?
If they keep writing it the way that they are, I'm loving it.
Yeah. Okay.
So... And last book I read, another book that's just in my wheelhouse, G.I. Joe. Yeah, this is the Dixon written version as opposed to the Larry Hammer one I just talked about. This is really interesting. It's part four of the Cobra Command crossover. One of the things I really love about the crossover is that they're actually keeping the viewpoint of the book central to the story that they're telling in each book. It's not as if it's a single arc. It's a very distinctive viewpoint. Now, G.I. Joe is about, you know, Hawk and Duke and Scarlet. And the center of the Joe Command Force. Yeah, J. Joe Snake Eyes is about Snake Eyes and what he and his platoon are doing. Yeah, Cobra is about the villains and what they're doing. They're keeping those viewpoints central to the books themselves as they tell the story. They're kind of bookending it with what's going to happen in the previous book in the arc. So you're seeing a little. So you might see a little bit of what Cobra's doing at the end of this book, indicating what's going to happen in the Cobra, in J. Joe Cobra. So I love the way that they're doing the crossover. So I think they've got it really tight. The fact that Dixon is writing two of the three books helps, I'm sure.
He's writing a lot.
Yeah. But this book mainly deals with how G.I. Joe is dealing with the logistics of the Cobra invasion. It's definitely a tactical idea. There is some fighting. There is some combat. But it's a lot of how G.I. Joe is reacting and the logistics of what they're doing to try and combat Cobra.
Okay.
All right, what do you got for me, Justin?
This week, I had a few that, some that were beginning, some were ending. One of the endings was Brimstone. This one completed with number 7. It felt like this one took a long time to come out for some reason. I'm not entirely sure why. The final chapter in Brimstone ends with a good enough bang to be very satisfying. It's a good, complete story. I do think that this one, if and when it comes out as a trade, will sell really well. I think having it serialized almost sort of did it a disservice. The continuous story, I think, will be better than waiting the month-to-month to get the issue.
There's been a lot of books out there that have been hurt by actually being monthly serials.
Yeah. I think this was definitely one of them. Yeah. If nothing else, I would like to see this book get picked up just for its art. Cho, who does the art on this, I actually spoke to the authors of this book. They said that when they found Cho, that it was just an absolute, you know, needle in the haystack, and they're completely right. His art for this book and for this story is just dead smack on exactly what it needs to be. So, if you have not read this series, and it does come out in trade, I highly recommend go and pick it up.
If you haven't, go check your bookstore shelves. Ask them. Diamond probably has got it in the warehouse. They'd love to sell them. So,
Oh yeah.
Check it out. 7 issues. So,
Not real long. Not real long. Yeah. Another one from this week is Magic the Gathering. This was number 1. I believe this is actually coming out because Magic the Gathering is going to be doing a new edition coming out pretty soon, which is going to be the Innistrad series, which is, for anybody that ever played tabletop D&D, around 2nd edition, there was a game world called Ravenloft. And evidently, Innistrad is going to be the sort of Ravenlofty version of the Magic the Gathering card game.
So this is kind of the land that all the villains go to when they die, and they live as villains in this realm.
The story of Magic the Gathering actually doesn't have much to do with Innistrad at this point, other than it ends with he knows that's where he has to go to find this stuff. He has to go to the plane of Innistrad.
Okay, because Ravenloft, the idea was this is where the villains go. The worse you were, the bigger your kingdom.
So a really evil guy got huge tracts of land. So.
Huge tracts of land.
This doesn't seem to be that way. I think it's just, it'll be a Victorian horror style theme all. So, Animal Man number 6. This one, as far as the overall story of Animal Man so far in the plot line, is kind of a throwaway book. Because this is actually set outside of the actual story. The comic itself is...
He's kind of done that with a number of their number 6s.
Yeah, but this one does contain relevance.
Okay.
In the sense that the story itself is actually Buddy's son in the camper that they're in watching a movie. And it's actually a movie that Buddy starred in. And it's about a family man who was a hero at one point and is no longer a hero, or he never maybe really was one. He just thought it was in his head.
A semi-autobiographical movie that he starred in that his son is now watching.
Yeah. And it's actually funny because on some of the panels, it even has, like, the panel itself is pixelated out. Like, the stream didn't come through right, or there'll be a low battery warning, like, on one of the panels. It's very kind of neat and cool how they did it, but overall, if you're reading Animal Man for the story of the Rot and what's going on with Swamp Thing as well, you don't need to get this book. It's not relevant to it, other than it's relevant to Buddy and his family.
Sure.
After that, the other one I want to mention quick is iZombie, which is number 22. J-Bone is off of it. Allred is back doing the art again. Holly, frickin' Luya. And Horatio is back. So for all those who have been reading the book for the fun little romance factor to it, her boyfriend's back, and now there's going to be some trouble. Other books I read this week, Wheel of Time continues to be good. Also written by Chuck Dixon, which I don't know if I had mentioned that to you or not. Lock and Key, number 4 of the Clockwork Cycle, which was an absolute just wall of exposition in this book in an awesome, awesome way. Swamp Thing, number 6, was also this week. Continues the Rot storyline.
Real quick, we will go over a bit more of Lock and Key in about a month.
Because it's usually a 6-issue run.
Okay, this is issue 4?
Yeah, this is 4. So we'll get more into Deep Roll in April.
Mm-hmm. Now, once the last 2 issues of this arc, and then we'll discuss the whole arc in one.
Which really is the best way to talk about Lock and Key, because to try to get stuff in between, it doesn't work.
Go pick up the early trades on that.
Oh, God. Pick up all the trades. Pick up the books. Please, people, go read this book. Swamp Thing number 6. It continues the story with the Rot. There is a bit of a turning point in this one, but it's really just driving the story forward. And Stormwatch is kind of, completing the last little lip of this arc that they had just finished. It's kind of tucking in the sheets on it, basically.
It definitely had a big splash ending on the last issue. I haven't read this issue yet. But the last issue, there was a big ending, and it looked like they could have gone in a whole new direction with Stormwatch.
And they really didn't. I mean, they basically, like, there was that big explosion. They sort of kind of wrapped everything up, and like I said, like kind of like tucking
in the
sheets.
They gave it a nice little bow.
Yeah, that's exactly the perfect way to put it.
All right. So
that was my stuff from this week.
Yeah, it seems like we both read quite a bit this week.
Oh, yeah.
So some of it good, some of it we weren't quite as fans of. But
oh, I should mention, I did, as we probably heard, I did read Franklin Richards' Son of a Genius as well.
Yes.
Which that was along with other things, but I picked up a couple of those. I love the art. It's
fun.
It's reminiscent of Watterson, even though the stories I wish were more like
Watterson. Yeah, I know you picked it up going, oh, it looks like it's Watterson, and it wasn't quite as fun. It's
still fun. It's still fun. It's entertaining. It's good for a younger audience.
Yeah, if you got a child, then Franklin Richards, Son of a Genius, is certainly good canon fodder to get them interested in sequential art.
Yeah, the only downside is we grew up with Watterson, and we can read those comics now, and they're almost eerily just as relevant, just as poignant, and just as funny. Whereas these, I think, are a bit more...
Yeah, actually, speaking of Watterson and relevant... Just the other day, I was over at your house, and just as Calvin's dad would answer Calvin's questions about the universe and how the world worked, you know, why does the sun turn red when it goes down? Oh, that's because it's burning the trees in the forest over in the east.
Yeah.
Those were the answers that his dad would answer. So we were over at your house.
I know I did something. I just can't remember what it was.
Yeah, I accidentally kicked the drawer open
on the
coffee table. So the drawer opens up. And your daughter says, oh my God, the drawer opened up, what happened? So you then pretend to close it with your mind, and I dutifully closed said drawer with my foot. She doesn't see my foot, she just sees the drawer close. And then you proceed to open it using the force. And it opens, and then it closes, and then
it was a thing of beauty.
It was a
troll dad moment at its finest.
So very much right out of the water. And that's why those feel so important to us.
It's because they shaped us. That's why.
Whereas the Franklin Richards books are much more just about a quick, fun little story. There's no philosophy behind it. Whereas Watterson was very much about the philosophy.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, these are good for like...
It actually does it a disservice to try to compare it to Watterson. Aside from maybe breaking somebody's expectations, which is good because
there is the quasi-Susie character in them, but... They're good for a short little yuck, and that's about it. That's all you're really going to get out of it.
If you're an adult. If you're a kid, then you're probably getting quite a bit more...
Yeah. You'll get more out of it as a kid.
And it's definitely... But it's aimed for children. It's meant to bring children into the comic book reading world.
So. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Well, moving on to news. First up of mentioning is that DC has announced that Captain Marvel will be officially renamed as Shazam. I think this kind of makes sense. A lot of people that are new a lot of people that are new to the DCU don't know Captain Marvel, but they know Shazam.
Actually, a lot of people, particularly if they've read Marvel, are going, "Wait, wasn't Captain Marvel in Marvel?"
Yes.
Captain Marvel, Marvel, and yeah. So there's copyright disputes over the name. And let's face it, even when I hear Captain Marvel, I think Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
Just even though I know he's a DC character, I know exactly who he is. I picture the giant lightning bolt and Billy Batson and everything. I still think it should be in Marvel character. So the renaming of it as Shazam is
does make sense. What makes me curious though is what are they going to do with Mary Marvel and with was it like the Marvel dog or whatever the hell his name
was? Yeah,
the whole Marvel family.
Yeah, they got a whole Marvel. We'll have to pick up Geoff Johns' book and find out. So
and
that's still a couple of months away before they actually bring that out there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it certainly is worth noting that they are going to be changing the character name officially so that he is Shazam. Yeah, it's the actual book. It's going to be Curse of Shazam, and it will have a backup story. It's going to deal with everything that we were just talking about with the Marvel family. Why he becomes Shazam.
Yeah.
So we'll get all of that, in dealing with this mm-hmm. once the actual series comes out. So if you're a Shazam character, let's face it, when he was Captain Marvel, he was sued because he was too close to being Superman. DC eventually put them out of business and took the character over. So there's not much, that he was, he's very much been a Superman-esque character. Yeah, he's been around since before Marvel, but...
Well, I mean, he's a keystone character in one of what I think is a very defining book in comics, which is Kingdom Come.
Yeah, Kingdom Come was an amazing series. If you haven't had a chance, go pick up the trade of that.
That's one of those, like, people that are new to comics.
One that's great to pick up.
Well, Kingdom Come, I would say, should be the second book they read. Because there's a lot of stuff going on in Kingdom Come that unless you really got kind of a grip on it, you're going to be lost.
Yeah.
I would say Identity Crisis first, then go for...
Even Identity Crisis. The problem with books like that is you do need some kind of history. And Identity Crisis, you still get a bit better of a feeling because you have a basic idea who's Superman, who Batman,
and it introduces you to many of the characters. Because the people that are not necessarily the B-listers, but you have like Nightwing, Firestorm, Shining Knight, I think, or something like that. Like, the characters are there, they're doing stuff, and people will say their names, they'll mention them, they'll talk to them a little bit, but they're not so central to the story that you have to know them.
Right.
So that's why I would say Identity Crisis is the best intro book, Kingdom Come is the best follow-up book, and then from there, set them loose. You know, find something that's in their tastes and set them on their way.
Yeah, personally, I think you find something in their taste and let them read that, and then start spreading them out. And but those are certainly good if they need an overall lore of a universe. Even though Kingdom Come has already been shown to not come true, it's one of those, as we talked about. Well, it's a predicted future that they've been able to change.
Yeah. And so, the other thing with those two books specifically, and I promise, so we'll move on after this, is that those two books really have meat. Like we were talking before about the marshmallow fluff of these other books. Those two have social commentary. They have heavy, heavy drama.
Yeah.
They have severe introspection of the characters. They have severe introspection of heroics in general and of the
world
they live in.
What does it mean to
be
a hero?
Exactly. And so, and adult. Not adult in, nudity or violence,
not
although there is
a decent
amount in both, but mature in that you have to have lived a certain amount of time to appreciate what's going on in this book.
Yeah. Now, I will give you that, Kingdom Come, Alex Ross's art, a youngster's going to love just flipping through the pages.
Oh, yeah.
But to fully grasp the story, it's going to be, it's one of those that you can read, go back and read 5 years later, and you'll get more out of it.
Yeah, it takes some heavy braining.
All right, but at least then we're going to move on, so it's
time.
And actually, there's something else that took a long time, but was the lawsuit between Neil Gaiman and Todd McFarlane over Spawn characters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Gaiman came in and wrote some for McFarlane. When he did that, he actually created three characters: Medieval Spawn, Angela, and Cagliostro. Cagliostro. Cagliostro, okay.
Who Cagliostro, if I remember correctly, when HBO did their Spawn series, he was one of the main guys in that. He also appeared in the Spawn movie. It's Cagliostro, that's the old guy that trains him.
So you've got these three characters that were created by Gaiman, and what happened is he created them and felt he owned, and because of the contract he had with McFarlane, he actually owned those characters. He didn't do it. It was not done as work for hire. And we'll talk about a bit of work for hire a little bit later on with probably the biggest story of the week. But so because he'd created these characters, they were ruled as his. And so to get around that, McFarlane created Dark Ages Spawn, Tiffany, and Domina, which were basically analogs for Medieval Spawn, Angelo, and Cagliostro.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, because they were analogs, Gaiman said, wait a second, those he took my characters, he just renamed them, gave them a slight redesign, I should get paid for those as well. There's been a whole lot going on with this, dealing with rights of who owns those characters, who owns...
Yeah.
Gaiman wanted the rights to Miracle Man, which McFarland actually only just owned the logos. Own the rights to the logos, so Gaiman got that, and then Miracle Man got bought by Marvel.
Well, let's say, fun side note, Miracle Man... Oh, no, sorry, I'm thinking Madman. Never mind. Yeah. Never mind. I'm thinking of different characters.
So, Miracle Man then gets bought... Most of the rights get bought by Marvel, so Gaiman can't get those rights back either. They eventually, maybe some single entity will own the rights to Miracle Man, or be able to make a deal with everybody that owns rights to Miracle Man and be able to reprint those into trade.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people that would love to read those books, but can't because you can't find them.
There's a lot of people that would like those to stay out of print because they have Miracle Man stuff and it makes it more valuable.
Absolutely.
Especially the traders.
All right. Yeah.
So yeah, the overall kind of story on that is they kissed and made up.
Yeah, they kissed and made up. And if you want to see what it kind of looked like, the Gutters has a wonderful explanation of...
Oh, I thought you were going to say there was a photo of it or something. I'm like,
there is. It's on the Gutters.
I thought you were going to look like Rule 34 it or something.
Nope.
Ooh.
Although I'm sure somebody has.
I just said it. It means it's going to happen.
All right. If you don't know what Rule 34 is,
don't go looking for it.
We're not going to tell you.
Oh, what did I do?
Okay, what you've done is you've discovered that Oklahoma City wants to put a 1% tax on violent video games. Now there's a number of things that come up with this, including how violent is violence enough for the tax?
Right.
Yeah. Is it shooters, first-person shooters, Dark Age,
What are they going to use for their...
Medieval, role-playing games?
Which, or even more so, would they base it on ESRB rating, which is... The ESRB is an independent board, aside from, it's actually non-government.
No, it's created by the video game industry
itself.
To govern themselves.
Similar to the MPAA in movies.
Yeah, the ratings that you have, the rating of PG-13, R, NC-17, PGG, those are all by this game. And if you look on your video games, they have an E for everybody, T for teen. It's on TV shows, they've got, television have their own. They all have their own rating systems. So how are they going to determine what these, what determines if it's violent enough? And just because,
somebody says so. Because the ESRB is basically just a bunch of people sitting around going, yes, this is this bad. No, this is not that bad. So if they do base it on ESRB, that'll be fairly good for the games industry because then it'll still be in their hands to decide what. Let them decide what is and isn't violent.
Without
the government basically sticking their nose into it.
But the question, but if they give it an M for mature, which most games, except for, I think, Grand Theft Auto, trying to avoid, and even Grand Theft Auto doesn't like that one.
No, there's a good number of games that are still mature.
There's one higher than mature, though.
You're thinking AO, which is adult only.
Yeah, the AO. Yeah. Everybody tries to
That's the same way as like getting an X rating, as far as games are concerned. Because it will not go into stores.
Yeah, stores won't carry it. So it's going to make it really hard. But where do you draw that line? A game could have foul language but not be very violent.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they're rated as mature, do they still get that 1% tax on there? Even if there's not violence, it's just nudity or foul language, the situations that they're putting you in as creators. I mean, Leisure Suit Larry has strip clubs.
Right. This is going to get shut down. I really think it will because there will be enough pushback as it being basically a First Amendment violation of taxation on morality, and it's going to end up failing.
Well, I mean, one of the store owners,
from a legal standpoint.
One of the store owners even brought up, if we're doing it on video games, why not on movies, TV, or music? Yeah. And one of the other things that the proponents of this were saying is, you know, this leads to violence, and this, you know, this leads to obesity. We get kids sitting around playing video games, and they get obese.
Okay, so just because it's a violent video game, they're getting fat. What, they're not? Just because they're not sitting around playing Sesame Street games, that doesn't mean that those kids are.
Yeah, Sesame Street games don't make you fat, but
yeah, but the violent ones do. That's ridiculous.
The darkness will. There's a whole argument about, you know, what video games can do that's actually good for you. And while there's been no conclusive evidence that playing those brain teaser games actually makes you smarter, it does actually show you how to build problem-solving, critical thinking, and reading comprehension skills. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are games that can teach you to do math or to type or to learn to spell. You know, and you know, they also build hand-eye coordination. That's been proven. You know, virtual reality games and other avatar-based simulators like MMORPGs have that immersive style have been shown to help treat post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah, these are actual medical studies and sciences that are being shown that video games are not necessarily bad. Now, I'm not saying that the 13-year-old kid that's playing God of War has post-traumatic stress disorder and needs to be playing it.
Exactly.
But but it does allow him fun, and it does reduce his stress. And they've actually shown that people that play violent video games are actually less violent in their everyday normal lives. It's where they can be violent in the games and not outside of it.
Yo.
So.
That's me.
Yeah.
Well, to short circuit this overall, I mean, this fight is one that's been going on for years. And video games are just one of the latest targets. The same stuff happened with comic books.
Well, actually, the use of attacks is actually the newest way that they're doing it. They've tried to stop it. They've tried to actually set up a government-regulated board. That's why we have the ESRB now.
Right.
So,
but either way, the overall argument has been true, not only for video games, but for movies, for comic books, and for many, many other things throughout the years. So I really don't see this going anywhere. I think it'll get shut down just on the legal merits, not to mention the fact that there's already precedents in place of things that may not be necessarily this tax, but that are similar enough to it that it won't fly.
Yeah, legally it probably will get shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, going on to something that's not going to get shut down, something that is probably the biggest news in comics to come out this past week.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be the announcement of Before Watchmen, this series of prequels that DC is going to be releasing, featuring the characters from the Watchmen comic from Gibbons and Moore that was put out 20-plus years ago.
Yeah, Watchmen, definitely another one of those books that is absolute comic canon. I mean, if you are getting into comics, and serious comics and mature comics, Watchmen is one that you have to read.
Yeah, not something you should start off on. Though.
No, far from
it. But it completely changed the landscape.
Anything that's Alan Moore, you don't want to start out on, because his stuff is a little bit out there in cuckoo nutty land.
He's a very mental writer. You are going to have to think about what's on the page.
And you have to think about what's going on between the panels and between the words.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of underwriting in it, for lack of a better way to put it.
There's themes on top of themes on top of, you know, it's just a whole big cake. And there's so much going on in this. When he writes a script, you know, most, you know, writers, you get about a page of, you know, what's going to happen per page of comic.
Mm-hmm.
And he's giving you 4 or 5 pages for the artist.
Per panel.
Now he's, some of that is actually pure description of there will be a feather up in the right corner of the screen. Some of that is, you know, but it's because he needs that much detail to give the full description to the artist. Now, the artist doesn't have to draw that line for line, note for note. They're allowed to interpret that, but it gives them an idea of what he's trying to impress upon this scene, what the important things are that are visually going to be there for you. So
with that being said, Before Watchmen is without Moore's input. This is going to be done as a different team taking the story, doing this prequel, without Moore's input. Because his whole thing has always been, I created it, it's out there, I'm not going to touch it again, I don't want to deal with it again.
Well,
Although
actually that's not the case. The actual story of Watchmen is, when they brought it out to be published, they said, They didn't know how well it was going to sell. They didn't think it would be great because it was entirely different from anything that was currently on the comic market. Comics back then were not the gritty, nasty, mean things that they are nowadays. They were a much more bubblegum flavor of comics, mm-hmm. this is one of the things that turned that dark edge that allowed characters like Wolverine to thrive. And what this has done is when they signed their contract, they said, we are going to give you the rights to these characters to publish this yeah. book, and you have the rights to the book and the characters until the book goes out of print. They expected a year, maybe two at the most, for this book to be in print, and then the rights would be returned to them. Now, in part, that's their fault for
underestimating their own success.
Well, for underestimating their own success and for not having a trapdoor clause at the end saying, you know, or until X 5 years.
Yeah. So whichever happens yeah. later.
Because of that, and because, you know, Moore said, hey, look, I'd like to have the rights to these characters back. I didn't know that the book would be in print for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this was 10 years ago. He's going, I didn't know it would be in print for 10 years. You know,
yeah, let alone
I would
20.
Like the ability to have the rights to these books back and the rights to these characters. So, yeah, with him going, you know, wanting these characters back and DC saying, nope, sorry, and you're not getting a higher commission rate on this either. You're getting what we paid you, and we're not changing the deal of the contract. It really pissed them off that, you know, this was, you know, that they weren't able to get the books back. It pissed him off so much. He actually left writing for DC. He stopped writing for DC. Mm-hmm. He eventually started America's Best Comics. They were bought by Wildstorm, which was bought by DC. DC was – he then found out he was working for DC. And as long as was told, you won't get – we won't have any input on your books with America's Best, he was okay with it. So
– yeah.
Now that, you know, it's been 20-plus years, DC has finally said, we're taking these characters, we're going to do new stories with them. Now, we're going to have a Rorschach miniseries, a Minutemen miniseries, a Comedian miniseries, a Dr. Manhattan miniseries, a Night Owl miniseries, an Ozymandias miniseries, and a Silk Spectre miniseries. Mm-hmm. So each one of those is going to have its own mini, approximately 4 issues each, depending. Some are a little bit shorter, some are a little longer. They've got some great talent working on this, you know, Lynn Wayne, Darwin Cook, Brian Azzarello, J.G. Jones, Andy and Joe Kubert, Amanda Connor, you know, others. Yeah. So it's a great creative team.
It's big names, big creative team. I almost wonder, though, if this is just a case of DC taking something that has been successful in the past and they're just going to end up raping it into the ground.
And that's what I fear. Some fans are like, yeah, I'd like to see some new stuff. I'd love to see more done with these characters. Some people say it's a classic as it is. There should be nothing else done to this.
Personally, I'm
completely alone. Personally, I have no interest in reading further stories either before or after this. But there's still the moral issue of, does DC have the right? Yeah, legally they do.
Yeah, legally.
But morally,
morally, they're a business trying to make money. I'm not gonna fault them for that. I'm not going to fault them for trying to take something that's successful and monetize it and make money off of it. That's what they're supposed to do.
Right.
I don't have to like it, yeah. But I'm not going to fault them for it.
Yeah. And yeah, as a fan, you know, I understand they're a corporation. They're there to make money, and they will. The fact is, yeah, as much as people don't want to see this, they're still going to go and buy it. What Moore has said on this is, I tend to take this latest development as a kind of eager confirmation that they are still apparently dependent on ideas that I had 25 years ago. So Moore is saying basically, and he also said this with the DCDU, is that DC can't move forward. They're stuck telling the same stories that they've always had, and they're just looking to make money off the same thing that they've always done. They can't move forward. And Moore is very progressive in comics. We talked about how deep in his style is. And coming up soon, I'll be talking about a book of his, Promethea, which I've been reading all 5 trades of, and I'll discuss that coming up in a future episode.
Alan Moore, I would definitely say, more than anything else, is very much an artiste, if you will, because he will do things in comics that nobody else really does. He has lots of wild out there ideas, and a lot of them pay off, a lot of them don't, but in part of being that high art idea is all the high art crap that comes with it, which usually tends to be the smugness, the self-importance, the inability to take a shower.
There is some of that, and actually somebody even commented, this from a guy who hasn't taken a shower, hasn't learned to take a shower. So there's certainly a lot of the art attitude of who he is, but it does show. The other thing is how will these creators handle, being able to work in with these characters, and how will they turn out without having that out there artist view that Moore brought to these characters? It really became a postmodernist view of, it was the first to really look at what makes a hero.
It was deconstructed superheroes. And it was the first. It was the first deconstructed superheroes.
And how will they be able to carry that thought through, particularly doing a prequel to this?
Well, the thing is, doing it as a prequel, they don't have to. They won't be deconstructed at that point. They'll be the Watchmen. They'll be the team. The thing that the Watchmen comic, after the fact, broke down. They get to write about what they know. They get to write superheroes and make them heroic.
And
they'll be what has become of superheroes since the time that Watchmen was published.
Right.
In that they will be the heroes doing the hero thing with their flaws, with their problems, with their little seedy backstory that nobody publicly will see, which is what heroes are doing now. Look through the stable of any publisher, and you'll find characters like that.
So you're taking something that became famous because it was a deconstructed story that was examining the motives and the theories and the ideologies of the characters, and you're taking
the characters, but of the genre
and the genre as well. And then you're taking that and you're pulling all of that out of it. Is it going to work? I mean, there are people that'll buy it.
I don't think it will. I really don't think it will, which is why I am not. No. Looking at buying these books.
And we've already discussed legally they have the right because, the book is, the Watchmen is still in print, so DC still has the copyrights to the characters and to the book. And Moore learned a sharp lesson about that. And there's a lot of debate about should they or should they not actually be doing this.
I think they shouldn't is a moot argument.
Well,
they're going to, and there's really nothing we can do about it.
If we look at copyright law when it was first enacted, it was you had 20 years to make money off of your creations. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks to Disney and other large corporations, and I'm pretty sure Warner Brothers, the parent company of DC, is probably on that list.
Oh, no doubt.
That has been extended to 70 years after the death of the artist. Now, there were a number of books that should be in the public domain that we can't use anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Once these characters entered into public domain, anybody that wanted to would be able to use these characters. So,
which is almost kind of true to a point now because the characters have become so pop culture that you can use them in parody, you can use them in fair use, and
yes, but you can't tell an actual story, and
that's it. Set in the with the character in the universe,
they were originally created and intended. You have to be making fun.
Yes, you can fanfic.
And no, because they can really go after you for fanfic as well. There's a fine line because you're not really making money, but if you have advertisements on your site for the fanfic that you're posting, now you're making money off of their property, and that's certainly a lawsuit that you would lose. Yeah, hopefully they would just say, please take this down, and you're done. But they usually encourage fanfic because it gets fans to look through.
Yeah, look at
it. If you challenge fanfic, you lose those fans. B, somebody reads the fanfic because a friend said, hey, I just wrote this story.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're interested in the characters, and maybe you'll go back and actually find the original source material.
Right.
To
move away from this topic for a second, because I saw something before I came over this evening, and that's somebody wrote a fanfic. And I'm a little bit embarrassed to say this. Somebody wrote a fanfic that crosses over Dresden of the Dresden Files.
Yes.
With My Little Pony Friendship with Magic.
Yep. Well, it stuff happens. And actually we have a wonderful Game of Thrones and My Little Pony crossover picture.
Yeah, that was
on our Google Plus feed, gplus.to/comicbooktesseract.
Mm-hmm.
Check out our feed and you can see what happens when Daenerys meets the ponies.
Yes.
But there's a lot, the publisher of Image actually put out, Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, meanwhile, created Watchmen under the impression that the rights would be returned to them eventually, within a year after it was concluded, in fact. That's not my opinion. That's fact. It's public knowledge. Due to the nature of the deal that had been agreed upon by Moore, Gibbons, and DC Comics, it was widely discussed. It was a genuine victory for creators' rights. But then the book was kept in print forever, and the rights to Watchmen never reverted back to Moore and Gibbons. And people wonder why Moore felt betrayed.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Like you said, I mean,
it's the publisher of Image Comics, you know, so, you know, there's, you know, Eric Stevenson weighing in on this, on how he feels that they're even being betrayed again by these comics. But everybody's going to have their opinion on this.
Yeah.
The fact is, the law comes down on DC Comics' side, and they're putting out the books. So? And they've got some great creators. Hopefully they'll turn out good. But
we can hope, but it's not going to be the tour de force that the original was.
No. So and that's really what it comes down to, is it'll be fun to revisit these characters, but it's not going to be the characters that you remember, mm-hmm. in large part because the story and the style and the deconstruction won't be there. So, all right. I think that pretty much covers it up, that being the big story for the week.
Yep.
So we already mentioned our Google Plus account, gplus.to/comicbooktesseract. If you want to find any of our contact information, you can go to about.me/comicbooktesseract. That's got our email address. That's got our Twitter address, our Twitter feeds. Mm-hmm. It's got our phone number, so you can leave us a voicemail, send us a text message. Any way that you need to get a hold of us, you can find it about.me/comicbooktesseract.
Yep. So, okay. And every week we also post on archive.org. We post on thecomicbooknerd.com. We post on – we have our RSS feeds and everything else, so – many, many ways for you to consume us. So by all means, do so. And
if
thank
you
very
enjoy
much
the podcast, yeah, please go to however you get it and leave a comment saying that you enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you don't like it, email us, text us, leave us a voicemail, tell us what you don't like. You know, give us the feedback to make the show better.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, but if you do, leave a review, tell a friend about it, get them listening. So
absolutely.
Anyways, we will see you back here in a week. Mm-hmm. We hope you enjoyed this podcast, and we'll see you next time with a Comic Book Tesseract.
This is mine.
That's yours?
Yeah, look.
Ooh, what is that? What book is that?
Wizard. Wizards.
Son of a genius. But you like this one because of what?
Dinosaur!
Dinosaur!
Wait, want to see the part I like?
Yeah, I want to see the part you like.
This heart is really the dog.
Doggy can teleport around, right?
Teleport.
Means he can zap himself from place to place, like to go outside to go pee-pee.
What else do you like about the book?
What's that?
Something bigger than this.
Something bigger than that.
Look, this is the little one.
That's the little one, and one there, that's the big one, right?
And what is Herbie?
Oh, yep, Spider-Man.
And what is Herbie?
A robot.
That's right, a robot. Oh, you like this?
It's a tree with teeth.
A tree with teeth. And then what's on the back?
Goldfish.
Goldfish, which you definitely love. You love goldfish, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They're yummy and delicious?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, you gotta go now?